First, a new report finds that the last two decades have been the warmest on record here in Wisconsin. That warming is happening the most quickly in the winter, and the shift is affecting winter activities and ways of life. As Danielle Kading reports, that includes the American Birkebeiner, North America's largest cross-country ski race, which will be held this weekend in northern Wisconsin.
With the sun shining overhead, Hayward's Stephen Mank skied along loops near the Berkey Trailhead as temperatures hovered far below freezing in Cable last Thursday.
I haven't missed the Berkey since 1985, and there's no sense in starting now.
The 68-year-old Mank remembers more snow and colder weather as a kid growing up in the 60s, but he says man-made snow has made a huge difference.
And as soon as the Thanksgiving comes around, the turkey Berkey, we're on the man-made snow, and so we're fortunate to live close to that.
Ben Pop with the American Birkebeiner Ski Foundation points out man-made snow loops as he walks past the Berkey Trailhead.
There's upwards of, in some of the places, 2 meters of snow. Other places only have, 2 to 3 feet.
Man-made snow is something Berkey officials hadn't seriously considered until they were forced to call off the race in 2017. Warm weather and rain canceled the event for only the second time in its nearly 50-year run.
The foundation took a real hard look at, okay, what do we have to do with changing climate and the like to really make sure that this always happens? Because it was really devastating to have the race canceled.
The Berkey contributes a roughly $20 million economic impact in the region. Pop says they've spent around $500,000 on snowmaking equipment. He estimates it may cost 4 times that to reach a point where they could hold some sort of race in a year without snow. That may be hard to imagine after 2 feet of snow fell in parts of the region this week, but winter has warmed the most in Wisconsin. That's among findings of the latest report from the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts.
That has been true in the past, and it's expected to be true in the future.
That's Steve Vavris. He's co-director of the initiative and a senior scientist with the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He says the state has grown not just warmer, but wetter.
The 20-teens were the second warmest decade on record in Wisconsin, nearly the warmest, and by far the wettest decade going back to the 1800s.
In the winter, precipitation has increased 20% since 1950, and it's falling more often as rain or freezing rain. John McCarthy with Friends of Lapham Peak says that's the trend he's seen at the state park in southeastern Wisconsin.
We get less snow, we get more rain, and when we do get snow, it's followed quickly by a warm-up and it melted or turned to ice.
Since 2004, he says the nonprofit group has spent more than $1 million on snowmaking for cross-country ski trails there. McCarthy says inconsistent snow makes it difficult to keep members involved with the Peak Ski Club. Jared Johnson with the Ebony Ice Ski Club in Milwaukee says they've also struggled to attract members as the window to hit the slopes has grown shorter in southern Wisconsin. Johnson says warmer weather can create riskier conditions that deter skiers. As ski hills rely more on snowmaking to stay open, he says that can increase costs that may be passed on to visitors and limit access.
It's much more costly to go skiing either locally or out west than it was in the past. And everything increases over time, but it has become almost unaffordable.
As people see less snow or opportunities to ski where they live, Pop says they've seen fewer people from southern Wisconsin take part in the Berkey.
If we do not have infrastructure like that where the people are, so in those population centers, people can't do it.
But he says those opportunities are expanding. He pointed to a Nordic skiing center being built in Brilliant that will offer cross-country skiing and snowmaking. He hopes that and the steps they're taking will allow the next generation of skiers to hit the trails as winters are expected to grow warmer in Wisconsin. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. Now, players on the U.S. women's national soccer team agreed to a $24 million legal settlement this week with the U.S. Soccer Federation, ending a lawsuit over unequal pay. As part of the settlement, U.S. Soccer is agreeing to pay the men's and women's soccer teams equally moving forward. One of the team captains, Megan Rapinoe, told Good Morning America that the settlement will permanently change the landscape of women's soccer.
It's a really amazing day. I think we're going to look back on this day and say this is the moment that, U.S. soccer changed for the better. I mean, obviously, we can't go back and undo the injustices that we face, but the only justice coming out of this is that we know that something like this is never going to happen again, and we can move forward in making soccer the best sport that we possibly can in this country and setting up the next generation so much better than we ever had it.
We're finding out what led to the settlement, what it could mean for equal pay in women's sports, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this lawsuit? Are you glad to hear about the settlement, or do you think it goes far enough? Do you think other sports need more parity, at least in pay, when it comes to men versus women's sports? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Molly Hensley Clancy is a sports investigations reporter for the Washington Post. She's been following this story. Molly, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So for people who haven't been following the lawsuit, can you fill us in on what the team, members of the women's soccer team, were alleging when it comes to unequal pay by the U.S. Soccer Federation?
Yeah, this has been a really long saga. It started back in 2016 when the women filed a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Basically, the core of their allegations is that the deal that the U.S. Soccer Federation offered to the men allowed them to make substantially more money than the women did. It's complicated, but they said that had they been paid the way that the men were paid, they would have made far, far more money. And that was kind of the core of the allegation. And you also saw them, they were alleging that there were inequalities in the types of fields that they were scheduled to play on, in charter flights. The men even made more money in per diems for food and things like that than the women did. So that was the core of it.
How large of a role did public pressure play in reaching this settlement? Prominent figures, including President Biden, weighing in over the course of this thing.
I think it played a huge role. A federal judge actually ruled against the women in 2020. So in court, it was very unclear how things would shake out. They appealed the case, they'd appealed it in front of the Ninth Circuit, which is obviously somewhat more friendly to liberal or their opinions. But I think that public opinion was always on the women's side for the most part. U.S. soccer was always dealing with criticisms, and they really did not do themselves any favors in kind of how they approached the case. In 2020, they caught a ton of criticism for making legal arguments that said that women athletes were less skilled than men and worked less demanding jobs. And that got them in trouble with the public, but also with their own sponsors. I mean, I think that the pressure from sponsors who, like the women's team, their women's team are a huge part of the reason they choose to sponsor the federation. So to have this fight was not just not good for the public opinion, it was also not something that sponsors were happy with.
Yeah, can you talk about the role of the women's team's success here? There are some sports where men and women in the U.S. do well on international stages. That's not the case here. The women's team, a dominant force in the soccer world. The men's team, is that part of the story? Is that part of why this particular sport could see a settlement like this?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely part of it. I mean, obviously the men's team has been doing better lately. They're sort of seen as a team on the rise, but historically the women have outperformed the men. And for the period of the lawsuit, you had the women winning the World Cup and the men failing to qualify for the World Cup. So the contrast there was just huge. And I think it wasn't solely about on-field performance. I think the on-field performance stuff led to this reality that women's games out-earned men's games for that period. Most of the sort of most familiar, most popular players for U.S. soccer were women. I mean, you saw players like Alex Morgan and Megan Rapinoe, who were just everywhere, Carly Lloyd, compared to men's team players that were maybe not as established, not as, attractive to fans. And so I think that the success really set them up to make this argument that, they brought in more revenue for this time period and that they were more popular than the men's team.
Now, for the Soccer Federation, a lot of times when you settle in a lawsuit, you don't admit that you did anything wrong. You just get it done. What did we hear from the Federation as the settlement was announced?
The Federation announced the settlement alongside the players. So I think that they're really trying to project a united front. They've changed leadership since this all happened. The woman, Cindy Parlow-Cohn, who's the head of the Federation, is actually a former U.S. women's national team player. And she said, you know, that she was the first to admit that the Federation had made mistakes in the past. I think if you look back at the time period where she was playing, the inequalities were even greater. I mean, so she certainly knew what it felt like, what it looked like to be, you know, paid less than the men, treated differently than the men. And so I think that for them, you know, it's not like they were outright admitting, you know, fault, I guess, but they were quite clear that they had seen, you know, they wanted to move forward together with the women's team, and that they had made mistakes. I think that also the amount of the settlement, while it was less than what the women had asked for, it was, you know, seen by many as basically a tacit admission that this discrimination had occurred, that the women were owed back pay.
We're talking to Washington Post reporter Molly Hensley Clancy about equal pay in women's sports, a legal settlement by the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team and the U.S. Soccer Federation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this soccer story particularly? What do you think of this outcome, this settlement, and acknowledgement that women were underpaid relative to men, at least under the terms of this settlement? Are you hopeful for more equitable pay in the future between men's and women's sports more generally? Do you have questions about this lawsuit settlement? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Molly Hensley Clancy of the Washington Post about the U.S. Soccer Federation reaching a lawsuit settlement with the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team over unequal pay over the years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of women's soccer? Are you encouraged by the growth of popularity in the sport? Do you think more equitable pay can help it grow further? Are you a fan of any women's sports team at any level? Are you hoping that there's more prominence for women's sports when it comes to things like media coverage, fan support, and pay? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Molly, this is all going on at the same time as another big story in women's soccer that you've been following. Abuse of young women in the sport by coaches, longstanding. I believe it was Megan Rapinoe who kind of connected the dots, saying this lack of respect in pay is part of a bigger picture of the treatment of women that led to this abuse. Can you update us on that story?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that was the dominant story in women's soccer last year was at least in American women's soccer, was that the National Women's Soccer League was kind of reckoned with this abuse scandal. It was initially professional women's players that spoke up both to me in the Post and in other outlets, saying that they had been verbally and emotionally abused by their coaches. One coach was accused of sexual misconduct with players. It resulted in 5 of the 9 male coaches in the league leaving in just the space of the year amid allegations of misconduct or wrongdoing. And then earlier this year, I also reported that one of those coaches had been accused of sexual misconduct with young players, with youth players back in the 90s. So it really, you know, has put together this picture of the way women are treated in American soccer. And there's a long way to go. I think Megan Rapinoe told me, you know, this is just the beginning. And getting equal pay is just one of the things we're fighting for. And they've had some very strong words for U.S. soccer about their failures to stop coaching abuse, to protect young players from abusive coaches,
and to
protect them from abusive coaches.
As you mentioned, this was a break. I believe you broke the story last year. What is the current state of affairs when it comes to looking into the allegations we know about and seeing if this is more common in women's soccer than we might have hoped?
There's quite a few investigations. I think the most major one is an investigation that U.S. Soccer opened into themselves, but it's being done by Sally Q. Gates, the former acting attorney general. And so she's currently in the middle of that investigation. The league is also doing its own investigation. You have FIFA looking into it. So there's a lot going on right now. I'm still, you know, looking into it as well. So I think that it's a story that's going to continue to develop. And you're going to see players really hold U.S. soccer and hold the National Women's Soccer League accountable. U.S. soccer oversaw the professional women's league for almost a decade during the time that most of these abuses happened. So it certainly played a substantial role in what unfolded in the league.
We're talking to Molly Hensley-Clancy, sports investigations reporter at the Washington Post, looking at a legal settlement between the U.S. Soccer Federation and the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team, a payout acknowledging unequal pay over the years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. To me, this is an issue of equal pay for equal value, like any employee of any company. And I don't know the answer to this question, but does women's soccer draw the same number of fans who pay the same ticket prices when they go to a game? And the television contracts, do they have the same value of the television contracts? And if the answer is yes, then by all means, equal pay. But if the answer is no, I don't see how you can justify equal pay because they don't have the same value.
Mark, thanks for the call. Molly, I guess the answer might be different if we're looking at, you know, the individual pro teams around the country versus the national team. What is the picture?
So it depends on what years you're looking at, but for the years that are covered in this lawsuit, the women's team actually out-earned the men in their games. In terms of television contracts, U.S. soccer bundles those together. So you can't really tell, who watches or who draws what numbers or what revenue from television contracts. We do know that the Women's World Cup games drew, you know, similar viewers. I mean, they certainly drew more viewers in 2015 in the U.S. than the Men's World Cup because the men, you know, weren't playing. So I think it does absolutely matter, the revenue. That was part of the women's argument, that they brought in more money than the men's team did for this time period. Overall, the men did out-earn them over, you know, decades. And I'll also note that U.S. Soccer Federation is actually a nonprofit. It's not a for-profit company. So I think that, you know, their mission is to promote soccer in the United States. And so you can't purely look at revenue because what the national teams are not just there to bring in money. They're also there to promote the game, get young people interested in the game and, you know, make appearances on television and all those kinds of things. So that there's multiple pieces of it. It's certainly more complicated than revenue and who brought in more money.
Thanks for that call, Mark, at 800-642-1234. I know we're focusing on soccer here, Molly. Is there any thought that this settlement might have ripple effects into other women's sports?
I think that the U.S. women's national team was in a pretty unique situation because of, again, the fact that they had been out earning the men for that period because of their success. But I do think that overall you see a real moment for women's sports. There's, you know, a huge investment that was recently announced in the WNBA. And I think that, for women's soccer globally, this will certainly be kind of a rallying point for other women's teams to, you know, we've already seen other women's teams in Australia, in other places push for something close to equal pay. I think that while the U.S. women were kind of uniquely situated in terms of being able to make this argument, because it's likely that we see, you know, more and more women's teams being able to, you know, make similar points about the value they're bringing.
Now, this is the national team level. I think I've seen some of the players involved in the settlement say something like FIFA next, FIFA being the governing body for soccer around the world. A former director there, I think, drew controversy for saying that, women players should wear shorter skirts or something along those lines. Is that an even bigger challenge than the national team might have been?
Yeah, FIFA is huge. FIFA is global. Right now, the disparities in prize money between the men's and the women's tournaments are massive. Of course, there are disparities in, you know, who watches the men's tournament compared to the women. You know, the men currently bring in substantially more viewers. However, I think if you look at it, the amount of men's prize money, many people would argue, is disproportionate even to that. And I think that from FIFA, what Megan Rapinoe and others, you know, many other people have been asking for is more equal investment, not just kind of equal pay. That, you know, maybe right now you can't, well, you could, because FIFA's a nonprofit as well, but you may not be ready to completely equalize prize money yet because of the difference in viewers. But, you know, there should be a far bigger investment in women's soccer globally from FIFA, because again, you know, their mission is to promote the game.
Molly, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Molly Hensley-Clancy is a sports investigations reporter for The Washington Post. She was with us today for a look at the equal pay lawsuit settlement between the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team and the U.S. Soccer Federation.